The history of our country includes violence, subjugation, and broken treaties with Native Americans throughout the continent. Exploitation, brutality, and manipulation was only exacerbated when oil, gold, or other desirable resources were found on tribal lands. I am Suzanne Lang, and I bring you a novel idea. Like so many of us who are curious about our ancestry, Marilyn Deer Nelson, with her husband, Chris Nelson, decided to explore the life of her great-great-grandfather, J.W. Deer. Equipped with some boxes of family archives that had been in storage for many years, the couple went on an American odyssey and unearthed a sweeping story of grit, courage, brutality, and friendship. Their resulting book is Red Cloud and the Indian Trader, The Remarkable Friendship of the Sioux Chief and J.W. Deer in the Last Days of the Frontier. So stay with us. It's a novel idea. Red Cloud was the chief of the Ogallala Sioux and led them in war against white soldiers, miners, and settlers who were aggressively encroaching into the northern plains. However, Red Cloud was also a statesman and diplomat. He signed the Second Treaty of Fort Laramie, which gave the Lakota large parts of present-day South Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana. This treaty and others would be broken by the U.S. government when politicians and wealthy entrepreneurs wanted the land's resources. Virginian J.W. Deer served in the Confederacy during the Civil War, and when the war ended, he was driven to acquire the financial means to rebuild the family home and security, so J.W. traveled westward and became an Indian trader. He also became a friend to the Sioux and an ally of Red Cloud's. Let's listen to our conversation. Red Cloud and the Indian Trader, The Remarkable Friendship of the Sioux Chief and J.W. Deer in the Last Days of the Frontier. Welcome, Marilyn Deer Nelson and Chris Nelson, the authors of this book. I'm happy to talk to you this morning.
We're delighted to be here. Thank you for asking us.
You tell a huge story that is woven really into the DNA of our country, from the Civil War to the Indian Wars, through the story of two men, essentially. Red Cloud, the Ogallala Lakota chief, who was a true diplomat, betrayed again and again as the fortunes of the West changed, and J.W. Deer, who fought in the Civil War, then went to the Northern Plains to find a livelihood, became an Indian trader and friend of Red Cloud, and a participant in the plight of the Sioux. So it's a big story that encompasses a lot of history and maybe some history that some of us are not wholly familiar with, and that is the gift of this book. So why don't you tell us how you, the two of you, got into writing this book and how you came to focus upon these two men?
That's up to me to explain. I always knew that we had a link with the Indians. We had trunks that were filled with treasures, an eagle headdress that trailed on the ground, beaded artifacts, stereotype images of cowboys and Indians. And in our family, my great-grandfather was a legend because he had helped the Indians. So lots of stories were told about him, and we were always fascinated. But our lifestyle was very peripatetic. Dad was a doctor in the army, and every 3 years, we moved in and out of the U.S., often overseas. He worked with embassies and military forts in various states and countries. So while we were away, those trunks remained in storage in the US, and the tales were not mentioned very frequently at that point. But I finished my university studies in California and followed my career to Europe and Asia, where I met Chris, who is British. We retired to London, and at that point, we realized we had time and the interest for me to now pursue that legend of my great-grandfather. Who was he? Where did he stay? Where did he live? Where did he move around from? Who were those Indians? How did he help them? When my parents died, they left a trunk filled with genealogy, and in it we found a diagram of something called Red Cloud Agency and the name J.W. Deere. Bingo! We now knew the name and how to start finding where he came from. So we started to research, and we had a fantastic time driving through Virginia, Nebraska, Wyoming, South Dakota, Kansas, and of course, Washington, D.C., with its wonderful archives. We visited the homes where he and the family had lived. We visited the trading posts or the sites where he had traded. And along the way, we met archivists, curators, historians, librarians, and unknown relatives. So we had a fascinating and interesting time with these people who were also helpful and curious about the story. And it gave us a unique opportunity to explore the U.S. So that's how the story started.
Did you know that it would become this book that encompasses so much, not of your own deep family history, but really of our country? Did you know it was going to emerge this way with so many connections to the Northern Plains Indians and Red Cloud?
We had no idea. We started out really as a family story. Let's try to understand who J.W. was and a little bit more about him so our family would know, the people who were left behind after my folks died. And as we gathered more information, it started to morph into more than a family story, but a book that should be told.
And I want to get into that book and this incredible story. But first, I have to ask, so this started as a family endeavor, as many people, when they have more time to dig in, they do. But then you decide you have enough for a book. And how did the two of you, a married couple, decide to approach this together? And how did that process work?
I've always been curious about and interested in American history. And like Marilyn, I've lived most of my life outside my country. So I've always been interested in other cultures. And Marilyn's family, what little we knew, were fascinating. So we decided together, and we love America, and Marilyn's got a lot of family in America. So we decided to start the research. And as Marilyn said, it just morphed into a far bigger story, because as you got to understand the man, J.W., we began to realize that his whole life was really conditioned by politics and what was happening in the United States at that time.
Can I add as well that if Chris hadn't been so interested and so encouraging, the story never would have happened. He has just been fabulous support.
Well, the story brings together the lives of these two men. And there's, in the book, a real building momentum to ultimately what each man face towards the end of their lives. J.W. was from Virginia, and J.W. Deere. And you tell us how he fought for the Confederacy with Mosby's Rangers, who waged war differently than other units in the Confederacy. And you really bring out the brutality of how our own Civil War was waged And from that perspective of him fighting and his brothers fighting with the Confederacy. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that portion of the book, which really does detail the home life, the young men going off to war, and that period of time when we were killing each other and burning out each other's homes and crops. And I wonder what that process of discovery was like for you and why you decided to include so much of it in the book.
Well, I think those early years molded the man. I mean, J.W. was 15 when the Civil War broke out. And I had no idea before we started getting into this just what a brutal and terrible time it was. And this young man was in the middle of it at the age of 15. His elder brother died at Gettysburg 3 years later when he was 18. And he, like hundreds of others, just thousands of others, just followed what was sort of prescribed for him and joined the Confederate Army. And the bonding that he had, I think, with his fellow guerrillas in the Confederate Mosby's operation molded his life and made the man he was. It gave him a confidence which had been missing before.
Yes, I think it was the perfect setup for him to then go to the Wild West. If he hadn't had that kind of a background, I'm not sure he would have survived very long. It was wild, it was harsh, it was brutal. So I think it prepared him, it matured him quite quickly.
And perhaps people who are more studied in the Civil War and the Confederacy will be familiar with Mosby's Rangers. I was not. And I found that a fascinating bit of our own history. And I think that it obviously did toughen him up and give him confidence as a man. And I think as a reader, it also exposed me to bits of our collective history that I think are important for us to see and realize and understand. No matter whose allegiance, whether the North or the South, there was a lot of brutality to go around. And I think that that still remains as part of our national psyche.
And I think that's so sad because both sides were doing what they believed in and what they believed was right. And once that war is over, people need to be able to stand back and say, well, let's live together. And that just doesn't happen.
You know, in fact, we are witnessing it in other places on the planet all the time. And I think it's important for us to see our roots in the formation of our own country. Once the war is over, as you say, J.W. moves west with the hope of making some money to help with the reconstruction of his family lives. And you fill us in on a lot of the politics and treaties of the time, including the Homestead Act of 1863. And you say, each year, tens of thousands of settlers, pioneers, and miners and their wagons scythe an ever-increasing swath of destruction across the fertile plains, killing the buffalo and game the Indians depended upon. And by 1867, the government is considering the establishment of reservations and using force if necessary. And you say the federal government wrestled with the question of how to handle the Northern Plains Indians. Should they attempt to assimilate, concentrate, or exterminate them? And this is what J.W. becomes involved in as he becomes an Indian trader. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that period of time and the structure. It seems like there was a heavy bureaucratic structure to corralling the Indians. and highly profit motivated, but there was opportunity for people like JW to maximize their own ability to thrive in this kind of new wild situation with this conflict of cultures. So talk about what an Indian trader did and the kind of structuring of these Indian agencies, which really wielded a lot of power.
The reservations for the Northern Plains Indians really sort of materialized in 1868 after Red Cloud had been successful with his war against the US government, the US authorities. He then took the brave decision to put aside the sword, and he saw the way forward as being negotiation and compromise. And at that point, he decided to lead his people onto reservation life. And that's when, for the Northern Plains Indians, the sort of reservation concept came into reality. It took another 3 years before the thing began to materialize. But the concept was that the Indians would give up following the buffalo, a nomadic lifestyle, and would live on reservations. But because their food supply, which was the buffalo, was no longer there, the government would set up what in effect were welfare centers and provide food and clothing and basic amenities for them. And at the same time, the government decided to allow specified Indian traders to work alongside the agencies to provide, to trade with the Indians, to allow them to barter and trade and buy materials that weren't provided by the agency system, by the government. And people like JW became an Indian trader. And his customers were the Indians. So his job was to get on with them and to get to know them. And he bought their furs and their bits and pieces, and he would sell them beads and ammunition and the things that they needed. And that's how the thing started. Over time, these traders began to offer more services. They had restaurants, they had bars, they did freighting for the army, and they provided other services. And many of them, and it was a way to make legitimate money. So that was on the one side, that was the traders. The Indian agents were the people who were in charge of running the agency and looking after 6,000 or 7,000 Indians. And their job was to monitor the number of Indians who were on the reservation and make sure, for example, that the food supplies which were coming in to feed the Indians matched up with the number of Indians who were on the agency. And that, of course, led to a potential for a lot of corruption and mismanagement. But that was the basic setup that Red Cloud committed to lead his people to in 1868. And that was the time when JW went west and said the moment that Red Cloud moved onto agency life, JW was part of that system. And that's why he was so close to the Indians and to Red Cloud for the rest of his life.
I am talking with Chris Nelson and Marilyn Deer Nelson on their book, Red Cloud and the Indian Trader, The Remarkable Friendship of the Sioux Chief and J.W. Deer in the Last Days of the Frontier. In our conversation, we mentioned Mosby's Rangers, of which J.W. Deer was part of during the Civil War. This unit of the Confederate Army functioned like guerrilla warriors, but they were authorized to do so by General Robert E. Lee. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Let's take a short break.
Thank you.
Let's return to my conversation with Marilyn Deer Nelson and Chris Nelson and their book about her great-great-grandfather, J.W. Deer, and Red Cloud, chief of the Oglala Sioux during one of the most tragic periods of Lakota history and a shameful part of American expansionism. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. What struck me was how everything was really rigidly bureaucratic, yet there was still a lot of graft and a lot of exploitation and I don't know, lying and a lot of power shifting. And JW was successful and he was able to send money back to Virginia and start building a life where he could eventually marry. And you talk about all this in the book, but he was essentially an outsider. And as many people were, but there were some people who were kind of entrenched in the early Omaha settlers with Republican and Union loyalties that maybe didn't like his success all that much. And especially when JW brings his brothers over to kind of expand his enterprise a bit. And that happening simultaneously to that band of Sioux being moved and moved and moved, and all the while JW is going with them, or trying to at least. So I guess I found it fascinating, that whole interplay of the enterprise and the government. And then you have these individuals, these Indians, who are really messed with quite a bit.
The story of the movement is quite tragic. When the government didn't make the decisions as to when the Indians were to be moved, and they delayed it until there were those dreadful winters, minus 30, and people were walking in moccasins and skins and walking for hundreds of miles. It was just terrible. And you understand how the effect it had on those poor people. It's been quite an emotional journey for us as we also uncovered so much of the story.
It was emotional reading the book, too. Sometimes I found it very difficult. These actions, especially after gold was discovered in the Black Hills, and that brought on a whole nother level of lawlessness and exploitation, that these actions are still with us today. I mean, we live with these repercussions. And that, I think, is what I found so astounding about the story, is that brutality was sanctioned. It was sanctioned by elements of our government.
People were driven by money. And suddenly land, which was seeming to be valueless, which the Indians were on, suddenly became something that people wanted because of minerals, because of gold, because of the ability to raise cattle on it, for settlers to farm. And the Indians were pushed and pushed and pushed. And I find it incredible when you think that in 1880, when you think about the Indians then, they didn't read or write. This was a totally spoken, they didn't understand the West at all. They had their culture, which was hundreds of years of culture, which is totally alien to our culture, but it was not to them. And they were really forced within the space of 20, 25 years to give up everything. Their children were sent to boarding schools, so they were could be taught to read and write where the parents couldn't. I mean, and to cram that change of civilization and culture into 20 years and expect you to come in one end as an Indian to come out 20 years later, somebody who's sort of fully assimilated into American life is impossible.
I think that's the tragedy of the story, that the people who were supposed to stop all their customs and traditions, their way of dress and so forth, to suddenly, who are they? Where do they belong? Who are they? And they didn't have a representative in the government who was looking out for them.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Red Cloud. He, unlike we may be familiar with Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, who might be better known, but they died young. And Red Cloud, as a young man, was a warrior. But as whites, as people migrated west and government followed them, he became a diplomat, really. I was surprised at how many times Red Cloud journeyed to Washington, D.C., meeting with several presidents.
He met four presidents in the White House.
And that he wanted peace. And he was willing to compromise on many things, but was ultimately treated so poorly. And it was just astounding to me that he was really trying to hold his people together and really trying to represent them and expected the same sort of respect that he was giving to the white people. And so talk about your own discovery of Red Cloud and maybe what he represents in Native American history and culture.
That's such a difficult question, Suzanne. From what we've seen, I think he was just a remarkable man. Because until the age of his mid-40s, his whole life was a warrior. And he was the only person to be successful against what he saw was white oppression. And he, in 1868, he got what he wanted. He could dictate the terms that he wanted to some extent of the deal that was done in 1868. And his side of the deal was that he would go to lead his people onto reservation life. And however you look at it, the government did not keep their side of the bargain. And he was disillusioned. But he was a 50-year-old man, and he was trying to lead his nation and young braves with testosterone pumping, and there were 18, 19, 20-year-olds. And he was an old man by then, in their eyes. And he was saying compromise and peace is the way forward. And these young people were saying, his young braves were saying, well, we don't want to go down the white man's route because we can't trust them. Everything they say they're going to do, they don't do. And he had this terribly difficult task of balancing these factions within his tribe and still leading them onto reservation life. And I think he did it fairly well. And I mean, he didn't read. The treaties he signed, interpreters taught him what they were said, and he had to put a cross on it. And then in his mind, often he thought he had signed something, and he was told that he had signed an agreement to something else. They weren't simple people, they were highly intelligent people, but they were still seeped in their tribal pagan world. And suddenly they were thrust into a modern American society. They found it very difficult to handle that. But I think he was a remarkable man. And he had a number of, I won't say they were friends, but a number of white people who he respected and trusted. And J.W. was clearly one of those. But I mean, he was very friendly with Professor Marsh, who, for example, was the world's leading paleontologist at the time. So he got on, and he was obviously a sophisticated man who could handle himself in many, many different situations. So, I mean, as we learned more and more about him, we really grew more and more respect. And he was a fantastic orator. And he looked so great. And he was a fine-looking man.
It's important to understand his role. And the time period we're talking about was also when the Battle of the Little Bighorn took place at one end, and then later, as situations are changing, We also, the time period encompasses the massacre at Wounded Knee. And I think for our readers and listeners, the Ogallala Sioux eventually were settled onto what is now the Pine Ridge Reservation. And even that, the name of it seemed like a slight to Red Cloud.
It was a complete slight. And the agent at the time was trying to suppress Red Cloud and any of the people who supported him. And it was sad reading to hear about his treatment by the agent at the time. And yet he still held his head high. He still had a following. His people followed him. And he was an amazing man who could live through the sort of situation that he was faced with.
Our guests are authors Chris Nelson and Marilyn Deer Nelson, who went digging into her family history and discovered a drama so embedded in our American story that they had to write a book, Red Cloud and the Indian Trader, The Remarkable Friendship of the Sioux Chief and J.W. Deer in the Last Days of the Frontier. I am Suzanne Lang. Let's take a short break. It's a novel idea. Stay with us. Let's return to my conversation with Marilyn Deer Nelson and Chris Nelson. I was intrigued with the trajectories of these two men, Red Cloud, leader of the Ogallala Sioux, and Indian trader J.W. Deer. I found that these two men had similar paths in a way, one leading his people, but J.W. was also trying to take care of his people, though on a family level, and they approached their endeavors with honor and were continually taking advantage of and lied to and lied about. And eventually this undermined J.W. Deer and kind of crushed his spirit. I wonder if you could talk about the discovery of that, how his trajectory went from success to really having a lot taken from him.
I think it was very difficult. I mean, he was at the peak of his career, if you like, if you measure it in business terms, in 1878 when he married his beloved Mary Ann. And she took the amazing decision to leave the sort of refined drawing rooms of Virginia and go and live with J.W., her new husband, on a trading post on an Indian reservation in Dakota. And then very soon after that, things went downhill, both for Red Cloud and for J.W. Red Cloud, because the authorities found him difficult and disruptive and a block to wanting to do what they wanted to do as speedy as they did, as they could with the Indians. And J.W., because, well, for two reasons with J.W. Firstly, because of his support for Red Cloud, and he came into, he supported Red Cloud, he and his brother supported Red Cloud, and this brought him into conflict with the authorities. And his trading license was renewed every year. And because of his support for Red Cloud, that was one of the reasons they didn't renew his trading license. And so his lucrative business, I mean, his play, he was employing over 100 people. He had the trading store, he had hotels, he had restaurants, he had bars, and he was doing well. And that was, at the stroke of a pen, that was taken away from him. The other thing was that a lot of corrupt politicians and Omaha businessmen were jealous of the amount of money he was making and the trading business he had. And we found an amazing smoking gun letter in the National Archives in Washington, where the two senators from Nebraska and the commissioner of Indian Affairs conspired together to take J.W.'s business away from him and to give it to one of their friends so they could make money out of it. And that was commonplace in what was happening in America. I mean, it was very hard on J.W., but it was commonplace what was happening, the corruption that was happening in America at that time. But that started J.W. on a downward spiral. And as the book describes, he lasted for 5 years and then died tragically when he was just 38, a beaten and battered man, very sad.
When he died, his wife was pregnant with their first child, and she was, I think, 40. Was she 40 years old? I think I remember
40
reading.
Years old, which was, I mean, she'd waited for him before they married for 12 years. And then when they were married, and they put, you see the letters they wrote, which we've all got in the diaries. I mean, they were in love. They were genuinely, genuinely in love. They adored each other. And they were married for 5 years. And then J.W. died, as you say, when Mary Ann was 3 months pregnant with Marilyn's grandfather.
In the diary, Mary Ann was desperate to have a child. And she marked out when it was her period. So was she pregnant? Wasn't she pregnant? And so when she finally was pregnant, it was such joy to her, such excitement to both of them. But the letters are full of love and devotion and never a cross word. It's just quite heartrending to read them.
Who wrote this book with, as you've described, a lot of personal information, like the diaries of Mary Ann Deer, J.W. Deer's wife, and of historical artifacts found in museums and archives and official records. So what was your challenge as writers, historians, bringing this information together about an important part of our history and story? It's an important part of your family story. And then to tell a story that readers can penetrate and that has some sort of narrative arc and everything, that must have been just quite a challenge to do. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your approach to bringing all this material together.
It was daunting. And at first, anything we found would go into the story. And it was later when we started working with the publisher that they said, we need to cut out some of the weeds. And we said, weeds? What's a weed? And they said, you're digressing. And yes, it's interesting to the family, but it's not necessarily to the reader. So keep it in your book for your family, but get rid of the weeds. And it made absolute sense because we had crammed everything into the story. So we had to pare it down quite a bit. We cut away a number of photographs of the images as well. So there's a lot more to tell. And there's so many, I think, aspects to the story of the love story, which we wanted to have come out, the Civil War, which molded J.W., his relationship with Red Cloud. All of those things are sort of sub-stories, but they are all part of the story that we felt needed to be told.
Well, it sounds like some of this information surprised you, and that this story is much larger than maybe what you anticipated, but still with the intimacy of this is in your family. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, while doing your research, you come to know someone who was related to Red Cloud. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
It was the most amazing thing. We were driving along the road in South Dakota. We went to the Pine Ridge Reservation, and we knew JW's last trading store was just down the road from where the agency was. And it was in the Nebraska side. So we drove down this little side road and stumbled across a building that had the wooden slats that looked like JW's trading stores. We stopped. It was now a cafe. And we went inside and asked the owner the history of the building. And she said, yes, from what we know, it was a postmaster's center because they found letters addressed to the postmaster in 1882. And J.W. had been the postmaster there at that time. The reality hit. We were standing in the makeover of J.W.'s original trading store at the 4th Pine Ridge Agency. We then asked the owner if she could tell us how to find Red Cloud's grave. We wanted to go and pay our respects. This was somebody we'd been researching and studying and felt an affinity towards the man, and we wanted to go to pay our respects. And she said, there's a lady there. I think you should ask her. At which point this very tall, regal Indian woman came forward and said, I am Red Cloud's 4 times great-granddaughter. I can tell you what you would like to know. It was unbelievable. Standing in JW's trading store, and we meet a descendant of the man himself. She told us how to find the grave, which we did, but we exchanged email addresses, and it wasn't long after that that we started to phone. And I speak with Limona probably twice a month. And that relationship has enhanced both of our lives. She's told me what life was like living on the res. She was still living up in South Dakota. And her stories about her family, about Sitting Bull, who in fact, her husband was directly related to Chief Sitting Bull. So when I met them, I thought, oh my God, I'm in royalty. Here I've got both Red Cloud and Sitting Bull at the same table. So we became very, very close. And when Steve died, unfortunately, very suddenly, the first person Limona contacted was me. And I think we share like a sisterhood. She's much younger than I am, but I think there has been a friendship that she can unburden herself with the stories of her life. So that was an amazing coincidence.
And what a completion to the story and life of J.W. Deere and Red Cloud to have their descendants be able to be friends and to share your lives together. Tell us her name.
She is Limona Red Cloud
Hawk. And in your book, you have a lovely picture of the two of you together.
She's the most lovely person. And it was such a thrill to meet her and to continue to talk to her and find out what the kids are doing. And she has a new partner, and she's now off the reservation and finding the transition so difficult to handle. But I'm so proud because the son just graduated from high school, and he wore his father's eagle feather attached to his cap. And he was wearing the special blanket that related to the Oglala Sioux. And he was the only one out of 250 young people who graduated that day who was wearing something that told of his life and who he was. And I was just so proud of him. I thought that was just, what a fine young man. He's now at university and he's studying business management.
You also mention one of your prized possessions of some beaded booties.
Those are incredible. They fit in the palm of your hand. They are beaded on the top and on the bottom. They are well worn. So my grandfather did wear those. And when Red Cloud heard, he heard that Marianne was pregnant. He sent these little booties to Marianne. And that was after JW's death. And it must have torn her apart. But those little booties are well worn. They're in my possession. And the beading on the top and the bottom means that his feet are sacred and they mustn't touch the ground.
Marilyn Deer Nelson, descendant of J.W. Deer, and Chris Nelson, the authors of Red Cloud and The Indian Trader, The Remarkable Friendship of the Sioux Chief and J.W. Deer in the Last Days of the Frontier. And I wonder if there's anything you'd like to leave us with, or maybe that you had hoped we would talk about.
I like circular things, and I think it's just amazing that JW met Red Cloud on the second Red Cloud Agency in more than 150 years ago, and that the two families, the Deer family and the Red Cloud family, are still in touch regularly today. I think it's a very nice, very beautiful sort of symmetry to our story.
Well, I thought it was a remarkable story to be told. And I wonder if the two of you have any other writing projects as this whetted your appetite for more endeavors this way.
You don't want to ask that question. Yes, we have. I mean, but it's totally different. Yes, I mean, there's two stories, but one of them is JW's son, who became a general in the US Army and had as remarkable career as his father did. He was in Beijing, the revolution in 1911. He was in the Philippines during the Philippine-American War, Spanish War. He was in Clebence at the end of the First World War in the American zone in Germany, and he was sent by Hoover to Russia in 1922 to help supervise the food program to help the starving Russians when 20 million people died. So he has a remarkable story to tell. Whether we've got the time to get round to do it, I do not know, but it's a possibility.
So you enjoyed the process well enough and the surprising things you discovered to want to take that ride again.
Perhaps.
I think so, yes. But it's time consuming, but very rewarding.
Rewarding and fascinating.
Well, how much time did it take for you to assemble all the material in this book, and not just assemble the material and do the research, but actually then to write it? How long did all that take?
7 or 8 years.
At the start, it was, oh, when we have time, we'll do a little bit, because it was a family story. But then as we realized that it was more, and there were so many remarkable things that happened along the way that said to us, like our meeting Limona, that this is a story that needs to be told. And then we started writing, and I'd say probably 5 years we're really focused on writing the book and fixing it up and realizing we don't have enough information here, back to the table, back to research. So it was intermingled with a fair amount of research. And of course, we had to do that in the States, because that's where the archives are, that's where the librarians are, and so forth. So great, great fun we've had along the way.
And I want to mention that there are also a lot of good photographs in the book as well. And that must have been quite something to pull all that together.
Many of them are from our archives, from the family trunk, or trunks, I should say. And where the image was not in great shape, we would source it from other places. But we needed to have images that would help to tell the story and perhaps give people a better opportunity to sense what it was like during that time and who were the characters.
I found some of the photos of the Indians very interesting to see. There's one photo, it was not of Red Cloud, but the man is wearing a jacket with buttons, but in his arm he's cradling a tomahawk. And I just thought that really captured this point in time where everything was changing for these people.
That's a very good point, and it's true. It was real transition, and it's expected to take place in, you know, 2 or 3 decades. I know the picture you're talking about. It was a spotted tail, I think.
Yes.
Yes, it's spotted tail. Yes.
Well, we've left out so many details that our readers and listeners are going to have to discover on their own, because the military has a presence in the Northern Plains as well. That's all wrapped around the desire to contain the tribes. And I found the characterization of some of the life as the area became people searching for gold and the ilk that brought in was kind of fascinating too. So I think people will enjoy this book. Well, it's not the kind of book you enjoy. You know, I there were times I really just, I didn't know that I wanted to go further because it was so painful. It was so painful for Red Cloud and his tribe. And it was so painful to see how J.W. Deere was treated by the establishment once it decided it needed to have more control of things and that he might have been a little too successful. It was hard to see, and maybe that was hard for you to see as well.
Was hard to see. And a number of people had said, oh, but it's such a sad story. Can't you make the ending happy? And we said, well, apart from Marianne having that beloved son that must have changed things for her, it's true. It's what happened. It's a true story. And you can't make a happy ending out of that, apart from JW's son being born.
And it was a story about JW. And people suggested that we should talk about the brothers and focus on Richard, who became fabulously successful. I mean, mind-blowingly successful. But that wasn't the story we set out to tell. We wanted to tell the story of Marilyn's great-grandfather and his relationship with Red Cloud. And it is sad.
And he was my legend.
Yes.
And still is.
Wonderful. So good talking to you today. Thank you so much for this book that is a real revelation. I think our readers will find it that way too. And I appreciate all your hard work, and I appreciate you talking with me today.
And thank you, Suzanne, for giving us the opportunity to talk about something which we've loved doing.
Yes, thank you, Suzanne. It's been a wonderful opportunity for us. So thank you.
I've been speaking with Marilyn Deer Nelson and Chris Nelson on their book, Red Cloud and the Indian Trader, The Remarkable Friendship of the Sioux Chief and J.W. Deer in the Last Days of the Frontier. This book was so informative, but also challenging as it presents brutal times in our American life and history. It's part of our larger conversation about our own national identity. I am Suzanne Lang. I'm grateful for production support from Mark Prell, Max Allen, and Will Penny. Our theme music is from Peter Jacobson. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Stream us online and subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. I thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.